I became broke, unemployed, homeless from January 1993. How did I navigate that? There's a time in our lives when we need help the most, but that help is not available. The only help available is reframing how you think about the obstacle that you are facing. You must figure out how to get yourself out of this. I took accountability of my situation.
My name is Sarah Kumalo, a businesswoman, a mother, and an award-winning mountaineer. I know what it feels like when the ground shakes beneath you. 3 times, Mount Everest sent me back down through avalanche, earthquake, and injury. 3 times, the world told me to quit. I kept going, and on the 4th attempt, I stood on the summit. Most would call the earlier attempts failure, but I learned something different. The shift is not the disruption. The shift is the lesson. It's not the fall that defines you, but the rise. Because true failure only happens when you stop taking the next step. In when shift happens, we explore the moments that break us and how they build us. Take a breath. The air is thin up here, and the views are worth it. Welcome to the summit journey. Let's go higher.
Welcome to When Shift Happens. I know what it means to face the impossible, to have mountains send you back time after time, and still choose to take the next step. But my next guest, Frank Magwegwe, knows what it feels like when the ground beneath you gives way, not just on a mountain, but literally in life. His shift happened when he was forced onto the streets, facing the ultimate battle of survival. At a moment when most of us would have surrendered and said it was a failure, Frank made a radical choice to rebuild his entire world using only the foundation of faith, education, and relentless hope. His journey from experiencing homelessness to becoming a respected executive educator and a leading voice in financial wellness proves something profound. Resilience is not a gift. It is a discipline forged in the fire of survival. We are climbing into the mind of a survivor to uncover the exact daily mental steps that transform survival mode into sustainable success. If Frank can rebuild his entire world from rock bottom, what excuses do you and I have? Frank, welcome to the True Ascent When Shift Happens.
Thank you. What a beautiful intro. And I really love how you have described resilience, because often people think of resilience as a trait, as something you're born with. And I love how you positioned it as a skill, as something we can develop. I look forward to going deeper into that conversation.
Oh, fantastic. So, Frank, who is Frank, apart from all these, you know, exciting stuff that we've just talked about? Who is Frank?
Yeah, so when I think about myself and kind of the journey that I've walked, I almost summarize it in 3 ways. So I think there's the non-part now, where I teach at KIBS, resilience, well-being, and corporate finance. That's one aspect. Then there's the other friend who was in corporate for many, many years. And then the one that you speak about that connects the two. I think for me, that's the friend that I want you to get to know. The young man who faced so many obstacles and kind of really to be brutally honest around the challenges that I was facing and navigating them, as we say, through education, through help from others. And the reason why that friend, that young 20-year-old, is important for me in this conversation, because that really has shaped who I am. My journey in corporate really spoke to, this is where I started. Yeah. And I learned a lot during that period. And venturing into academia was also just a belief that at 43, I said, you know what, why don't I start a journey to get a PhD and persevere? And 5 years later, and I had my PhD and got an opportunity to teach at KIBS. So it all starts with that 20-year-old, I think.
Amazing. That reminds me, I need to respectfully say Dr. Frank Magwegwe. Anyway, every shift starts with a breaking point.
Yes.
Take us back to that moment when life forced you onto the streets, when survival became the only focus. What was the hardest part of losing everything? And what was the first mental step that helped you begin the rebuild?
Ah, my goodness. You're really taking me back. I love reflecting on my journey and, you know, kind of grabbing lessons from there. So I think to anchor the period, so think of Johannesburg, 1992, and I arrived in this big city for the first time in November. And like most young people, it was about, I'm going to find, I didn't use that language, but almost think of finding my fame and fortune, right? Because you grow up with just this idea that there are people who go to the city and sometimes you miss them for a while as your relatives. And then boom, they come, they're dressed well, they have a car, which means something happens in the city. Yeah. That was kind of the vision that I had. So I arrived in Joburg and the idea was I had completed matric in 1991 and no money to go to university. So I must go and see if I can find a job. And by then, I'd already struggled somewhat with youth unemployment because I had finished matric end of 91, right? And this is only November 92. In between, it was really kind of struggling. And the first challenge for me was convincing my aunt, Christine Jika, that please look after me in Joburg. I know I came unannounced. I think I'll be able to find a job. Right? And she emphasized, you need to get a job, almost with that emphasis of, it's a little bit hard here in Joburg, something that I found surprising. And so the biggest challenge first was waking up every single day in downtown Joburg and walking from Joburg CBD to Boysens, to GP, to Crown Mines, to East Gate, to Bass Valley. And in between, asking at a garage, at a spa, at the bank, do you have work? I'm looking for work. I'm looking for work. So for me, that challenge as a young 20-year-old of unemployment has really shaped who I am. And so to answer your question, that's when my first shift happened. The shift from, okay, I've come from the Eastern Cape. I am arriving in Joburg and boom, it is hard to find work. And you have the tag of your unemployed.
You've taken me back to all those placards that sometimes when you have a job, you think they're insignificant, but they are to say no work here. They don't want to be disturbed. For someone that doesn't have work, that has a completely different meaning to somebody who's just walking around, coming from work and going home.
And you know what that triggers for me, Sarah? And it's so interesting to listen to you and the deep perspective you have that, in my experience, very few people connect that sign. So let me take you to the second shift, right? Because you're asking, what was happening in my mind?
Yeah.
So I'm unemployed. I go from factory to factory, from one garage to the other, and I'm just hearing rejection, right? Yeah. No, there's nothing. There's an opportunity. No, come after next week or whatever, but there was nothing now, right? And you raise such a good point because it took me a while to figure out, why does that no work sign, why is it a trigger for me? So as I was sharing my story about 15 years ago, when I started sharing a little bit of my journey, I went to look for places with that sign. So, you know, you go to a factory, you go to a construction site. And I saw to take the picture of that red circle, no work, with that white background.
Yes.
It was such a trigger for me. Why? Because there's a shift that happened in me as I was job seeking. And I would get to the factory and the gate is closed, or you just have this sign or a construction site. And the shift was this. Here am I, young, eager, willing, able to work. But society is telling me they have nothing for me. And who's society? It's the employer who has put this sign to say, don't even bother coming in.
Yeah.
We don't want to talk to you. We don't have this. It's not like they're not caring. They're busy doing their stuff. And the shift that happened for me, said at that time, was this. There's a time in our lives when we need help the most, but that help is not available. The only help available is reframing how you think about the obstacle that you're facing. So for me, it was, okay, they don't want to talk to me. It's fine. This one doesn't want to me to go in. I hope the next factory, they don't have this sign. The next company, they don't have this. I must just look for those willing to listen to my story. That was the second shift, dealing with unemployment.
Amazing. That's interesting for a 20-year-old. Eh?
Absolutely.
Interesting. But the power of reflecting.
Yes.
So many South Africans feel like they are constantly starting over.
Yes.
Financially, emotionally, even spiritually,
yeah.
If we were to be honest.
Yes.
What were the first three principles you lived by when you began rebuilding your life from nothing?
Oh, that's such a deep question. So when I look back, so I've talked about kind of these shifts. Maybe let me mention the third shift, then I'll pull it all together, right?
Yeah.
So I arrive, my aunt, I'm looking for work. Mm-hmm. 6 weeks into trying to find work, my aunt essentially, with the family, it was hard for them. Things were also tough for them. They could not look after me.
Yes.
So the next shift after, so it's almost got this metric, come to a big city, unemployed, you're trying to find work, stay briefly with a relative. Then the next shift that will help answer your question was, we actually can't look after you here. And so I became broke, unemployed, homeless from January 1993. Right. Now we are getting to, how did I navigate that? Because I'm not the only one who has had this shift of circumstances. As you say, kind of the ground has shifted. You face this big obstacle. It's so interesting, Sarah, when I go back. One, you're asking for three things. The first one, and I don't, well, for now I'm going to say it, I don't know, right? How? But later I'll give you an answer that helps. So I don't know how come I thought about it this way. So the first thing was this. I said to myself, you got yourself in this. You left Port Elizabeth then, right, to get to Joburg. You caught yourself in this. In other words, you came, you now find yourself homeless. You must figure out how to get yourself out of this. And I know it almost sounds like, really, when you're facing that obstacle, for me, it was almost like a natural place to go, to say, I must figure out how. So the first thing I want to offer is this. I took accountability of my situation. This is me. I'm in Joburg. It's tough. I didn't take that away. So almost like, Sarah, I was brutally honest about my situation. What happened? Well, you tried to come to Joburg to find work. You're not finding work. You're now homeless. Who caused this? Well, partly it's you, because you decided to come. So figure out how you're going to navigate it. So kind of that honest with the situation and taking accountability, for me, was the first big step.
Wow. Amazing. It's actually the most important. Many times we shift the responsibility to other people.
Right.
Blame. You could easily say it's your aunt.
Yes.
But she had her own shift going
absolutely.
On.
Absolutely. Things were tough for her.
Absolutely.
And so when that happened, and in my own reflections, because I've thought about it and I've told this story, I've told my kids this story. Once I had taken ownership, Sarah, something happened inside this 20-year-old. It was no longer this huge monster that, oh, I'm homeless, I'm broke, I don't have money. What am I going to do? It allowed me the next step to be resourceful. Once I'd taken ownership, and I'm going to tell you how. So firstly, okay, I'm there on 60 Plain Street. I don't know people in Joburg. I only arrived 6 weeks ago. And I said to myself, but wait a minute. I've passed around Park Station. I don't think anyone can chase you away from me. Train station. So why don't I go there? At least I spent the evening there. Little did I know that was going to be my home for 7 months, from January 93 to July 93. But I want to illustrate how being honest about what's going on, what's my obstacle, what is the shift that has happened? Well, the shift is you're now homeless. You're broke, unemployed. You don't know anyone in Joburg, right? And what are you going to do about it? Well, I contributed to it. I should figure out a way of getting that. Actually gave me power be creative around it. And then this idea is my next step. Say, okay, you know, in the evenings, I'll have to go to Park Station. During the day, I must continue trying to find work.
Amazing. When you take accountability, as I listen to you and become resourceful,
yes,
you stop being a victim.
Yes.
You're owning your next steps.
And so that's why the first step was taking that accountability. And did you see the resourcefulness coming?
Exactly.
Let me add the third thing. And this is a little bit after some time of trying to figure out how do you survive at this train station, right? So I've taken accountability. I'm thinking about it. I brought myself in here. How am I going to get into driving that resourcefulness? One of the most important lessons that has stuck with me, and people who haven't been in this specific instance of homelessness, who see homeless people from far, they do not realize the third thing that I'm going to share with you. And it is this. There is so much camaraderie among homeless people. Why? Because this group of people are united by one thing. Something profound happened in their life, and so did in my own life. So there's this common goal to try to overcome homelessness. And so I found willing ears to say, guys, I just got here. And not so long time ago, I was in high school. And I'm just trying to find a job. How do I survive on the streets? And when I talk camaraderie, let me give you two examples. Two examples. The guy say, oh, okay. Firstly, they laugh. Hey, wait, it's going to be long. What do you mean? Me, I'm going to be out of here by March. They say, whoa. It's better if you don't have a hard deadline. Right? Just say you'll overcome it because you're setting yourself for disappointment. Just think about that. There's another human being already sharing how tough it has been for them homeless. It's not saying you're not going to overcome it. They just say, have reasonable expectations. One. Two, I said, my friend, how do you survive? And they say, well, okay, it's a little bit hard, but you know, everywhere you walk during the day, look for bottles to recycle. In other words, those days you could go with an empty bottle of beer, an empty bottle of Coca-Cola. You take it to a supermarket or bottle store, you'd get 10 rand, 20 rand, so they want of recycling. Then you'd remember to get something to eat. And then the other thing was around this idea of you can find leftovers in restaurants. And so what I'm saying is, it's so often that when shift happens, and that's my third point, sir, I want to emphasize this, we think we must solve the obstacle ourselves, the adversity. Here I'm saying, yes, I had that accountability to do, but I found a lot of support and joy from other homeless people guiding, sharing the thinking, comforting when it's tough. And so we must not forget the role of others in helping us face obstacles.
You know, in mountaineering, I always say nobody gets to the top alone.
There you go. It's exactly the same principle.
Everybody needs a partner, and they've learnt the ropes.
Yeah.
And they were sharing that.
That's amazing.
Amazing. Thank you for sharing that. So the next question really is, you often speak about education as a turning point in your story.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. What role did learning, formally or informally, play in your transformation, and how can education still be a catalyst for ordinary South Africans facing extraordinary struggles today?
Yeah. Wow. That is such a brilliant question. I'm going to start answering this way. A lot of people, when you mention education, they've got a stereotype, Sarah. They think classroom.
Yes.
At university, at a technicon, at any higher institution, or of course, even primary school, high school, right? I want to break education into two parts, linking into my story. The first part, the informal education that laid the foundation for the formal education at VETS, right? Was the education to survive 28 weeks homeless in downtown Joburg. It's not in a textbook. It's not theory. It's about, I'm angry today. I'm frustrated. There's this stereotype around homeless people, uneducated, for example, petty thieves. But anger is not going to get me off the streets. Do you see that education of self-awareness? I'm angry, I'm frustrated. But this is not going to solve the problem. I need other human beings, right? Or I'm hungry. I know how to take away the pangs of hunger. I must just smoke glue. Then I say, whoa, this is not going to take me off the street. Other homeless people might be smoking glue to dull the hunger pains. I am not going to do it because if I get addicted to this thing, I'm in trouble. There's education, asking for help, walking into the Methodist Church on Small Street and saying, is there anything I can do here? I am unemployed. I am broke. I sleep at the station. And so learning to ask for help, education, learning to be vulnerable, right? Learning to be self-aware, learning to manage emotions, and ultimately being resourceful and surviving on the streets of Joburg for that long. That's education. And often the mistake we make, we do not reflect on informal education. What am I learning about myself? Because every day we can learn something about ourselves, right? What's going well? I should do more of it. What's not going well? I should do less of it, right? Am I vulnerable enough when things are tough for me? How do I deal with my emotions? Do I bottle them or I have ways to express them, right? So informal education for me is essential. Then let's move to the formal, because I know people are going to say, but you're not going to get a job, you know, when you go for an interview and you say, I have tons of informal education. You need a piece of paper, right? That piece of paper, absolutely critical. What has it done for me? Yo, I would not be here if I hadn't been to vets. And the reason I would not have been to vets if I hadn't had good grades in matric. So for me, education has opened the door in that, having been broke, homeless, and unemployed, but with a piece of paper that says good high school, good matric, that piece of paper, what it did, it opened the door in this way, the other shift in my life. So I was homeless, then overcame homelessness through selling fruit and vegetables in downtown Joburg. Then eventually towards the end of 93, I met a lady who said to me, but you sell fruit and veggies. What do you aspire to? What's your end goal? And almost like as a young person who just dreams big, I just said, well, I really want to get a job like at a bank. Because for me, my extended family, no formal employment. So driving a taxi, sort of informal work. So a bank was kind of, would be a good job for me in professional, right? So I mentioned that. And this is, but what's this metric that you speak about? What is it like? So I said, goodness, I've got a B in maths. So you must be at university. So here's a shift of how the education of having metric in this instance, an okay metric, leads to someone say, but then why don't you go to vets and see what you can study there? No, I don't have the money. And a shift happens. But you don't always need money. Please go to Braamfontein. There's the South African Institute of Race Relations. Ask them if you can qualify to get a bursary. I do that. Apply to vets. Apply for a bursary. Both come together. February 94, the shift happens. I'm now first year student at vets. So education, without a doubt, it's critical in that you go to university because you've got good grades, you've got good metric. It opens that door. University, we know unemployment hits people without metric the most. So education is key. The most people unemployed don't have metric. Then we move to the people with metric. Then the people with lowest unemployment rate, even though there are millions of them, it's graduates, right? They have a piece of paper that can transform their life. So for me, education has played that role. And I like to combine the formal education with the informal, constant learning about self. And it was the bridge, without a doubt, of then finishing at vets with honors in finance and joining the financial services in South Africa.
Amazing. Amazing. It's a humbling journey. As you speak, I know education is quite key and an anchor. Something else that you have touched on that's important is you talked to people.
Yes.
You reached out, you engaged, you told them you have this and they gave you options.
Correct.
Without that, you wouldn't have connected on your own. So I think sometimes when we are in trouble, we think we are alone. No one is listening.
And my point earlier on when I was saying, do you realize the camaraderie that kept me sane, the sharing of food, the it's going to be okay with other homeless people, right? And so in their own indirect way, they contributed. And so for any South African who is experiencing any shift of some sort in their own life, my own experience and the research that I do at Gibbs on Resilience has shown me that one of the, I almost think of it, Sarah, is the engine of resilience. In other words, the engine for the skill to overcome obstacles. It's reaching out to others. We call it social support. Just no man is an island.
No.
Be vulnerable enough to tell someone what you're going through. You know, it's so tough. I've been looking for work for 7 months. I'm about to give up. And that person may just connect you. So you actually need to be connected. And often they call it social capital. Having a social network that can lead you to opportunities, or someone connected to someone who gets you an interview, someone connected to someone who gets you interview skills or things like that. So definitely working with others is a skill we need to overcome adversity.
You know, survival mode sharpens your instinct. Yeah. When I listened to you, you became resourceful, right?
Yes.
But it can also trap you in fear.
Yes.
You know, how has that journey changed the way you lead, connect, and measure success, especially in a country still struggling with inequality as well as unemployment?
Wow, that's such a brilliant question, because what you are linking to, Sarah, is this. Our leading formal roles in corporate, let's say, or in society in general, it is informed by the stories of our lives, the journeys that we have overcome. The question you asked at the beginning, who's Frank? Right? The young person, unemployed, coming to a big city, dreaming big. And so, how do I lead informed by that story? How do I define success? So, starting with the leading part, I've been privileged to lead in many organizations in South Africa. And what I now know about myself through feedback from them, people always tell me, you lead authentically. It's you. You lead with heart. You okay to share your thoughts, your struggles. I don't know everything. How can we do it together, you know, as a team to solve the problems facing us? So kind of that humane leadership, where to put a label to it. And I'm not surprised when people give me that feedback, because having been down, broke, homeless, unemployed, and building my way up, one of the things that I learned, and it's a guiding light in how I run my life, Sarah, is this. Everyone matters. You matter not because you climbed Kili and then Everest and the Seven Summit. I matter not because I teach at Gibbs. You don't matter because you're a parent. You don't matter because you're CEO of a big corporation. You matter because you're human, period. And so I learned that through the journey of homelessness, that everyone matters. Everyone is here because something profound happened, and we can work to overcome challenges, right? And so I overcame homelessness, and what it has created in me is this huge sense of every individual matters. And so my leading starts there. The receptionist matters. The security guard matters. The person in the call center matters. Why? Because they're human, right? And I think when we make people feel they matter in our leading, magic happens, because they feel they can contribute to society. They add value. When we say people matter, by the way, we are also interested in their stories.
Yes.
Who are you? Where do you come from? How many kids? What are your ambitions? Right? And when we say people matter, we are able to go back to that time when we desperately wanted to be a leader. Right? We say, I'm ready to be a manager. And someone says, you're not ready. I want to be a manager. Someone says, you're not ready. When someone now comes to you and they say, I think I'm ready for promotion. When you treat them as they matter, firstly, you think about that time when, what was it like to want to be a manager? And people said, you're not ready. And then you'll engage very differently. Yeah. Right? So I fundamentally believe in this idea, everyone matters. How does it show in how I define success? I've thought a lot about that. And for me, in my 30s, success meant a big car. Success meant a big house. Success meant holidaying wherever I want to holiday. Right? Something happened from sort of mid-40s. And I think I did not realize that I'd been in search, without using those words, for purpose. I've done well in corporate. What impact can I make? What more can I give society? Am I just here to drive a big car, drive a nice house, go on holidays, or there's more? So a shift happened for me probably when I was hitting 43, 44. And I realized, if I believe people matter, if I want to run my life with people matter, I want to be known as someone who makes people feel they matter, one. Two, I want to be known as someone who contributes to helping others understand the importance of treating everyone as if they matter. The combination of those two in my financial background, it was in front of you, you were looking. Use my ability to explain difficult technical concepts in easy way. Use my storytelling to empower individuals whether they're facing the adversity of financial stress or unemployment or a retrenchment or marital strife, to tell people the power of resilience, the power of how thinking about problems, vulnerability, reaching to others can help us. So these days, I measure success. If you look at what I drive, old 17-year-old car that I've been driving for 15 years, I measure success when I have a conversation like 2 days ago with my daughter. I said, Nana, I'm prioritizing you. She said, why, Baba? I said, because I want to be a better parent. I want to be a better sibling. I want to be a better faculty. I want to be a better citizen. Every day I measure success with how I'm showing up and how people are experiencing me. It's no longer just about finances or titles. And it has been a decade journey to get there. That's how I measure success.
I'm smiling because I worked in one of the corporates with you. You're one of the few executives that I would find in the canteen having a deep, detailed conversation with somebody that works in the canteen. I'm sitting there thinking, that's me.
Matters.
Exactly. So you're not just talking, you leave the brand.
Ah, thank you for
that. So I appreciate that. Yeah. So as a thought leader in financial wellness, you know how money stresses affect the emotional and mental health, right? What are three simple but powerful financial habits that can help South Africans, no matter their income, regain control and a peace of mind?
And isn't it exciting, Sarah, that those three things are there and they exist, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Because then we can use them to shift our money story, to shift our relationship, to shift our finances and raise our families better and achieve the goals, because money is so central to our lives. The first one that many people don't realize is nothing to do with your bank balance, is understanding what money means to you. I told you, Sarah, and you know, my old jalopy, right? It's 17 years old. I've driven it for 15 years. Why? Because money means security to me. Right? And so I'm saying I want to invest. I want to wisely invest in myself, invest in other things, because that's what money represents, security. And you can see someone has been broke, homeless, unemployed. Kind of, I also don't want to go back there. So I always have emergency funds. I'm using my money wisely. It's not to say it's right or wrong. For another person, money may mean freedom, power, status, security, love. What I want people to understand is this. That which money represents drives your financial behavior. If money means status, look at your wardrobe. Look at how many sneakers we have. Look at your clothes, branded versus non-branded. Look at your phone. The answer will be in front of you, right? And it's not to say there's right or wrong. It's to say one of the powers to unlock what you do with money is to understand what it represents. And then to say, it has to be about balance. If your dominant money story is it represents status, then it can go in overdrive. Because, you know, our grannies were right when they said everything in moderation. So if it's status, it's the phone, it's the shoes, it's the dressing, it's the right address, it's the right holidays, you may be heavily indebted as a result of money meaning status, and they are chasing that status. You need a balance. You need a bit of planning. You need a little bit of security. So understanding that through many quizzes that are available on online platforms, almost all banks have them, it will help, number one. Number two, someone is going to say, Doc, you can't eat status. You can't eat what money means to you, right? Give me something more practical. Let's go to the next one. I think people often underestimate that one of the things that unlocks what we do with money is simple. And it is the simple, humble act that is called budgeting. What does it mean? It simply means you are telling your money where to go. You're saying, 1,000 rand comes in my account. I take away 300 rand. I use it for rent, for transport, for food, for school fees. What am I left with? Is it enough? No, it's not enough. I must do more so that I can bring more money. Also, where I am putting this money, is this aligned with where I want my life to go? So in other words, those categories, your needs, your wants, right?
Mm.
So a budget is such a powerful planning tool because it allows you to constantly reflect on what you are doing with your money. And you get feedback. When that debit order bounces, there's feedback that there was not enough money in the account. When they call you about a misplaced payment, there's feedback, right? And so for me, it's not about having lots of money. It's about having the discipline to manage even the small one through the tool called a budget. So that's what my second offering. Third one is this, and it's the hardest. We're also told when you start working, many people tell you, spend less than you earn. My goodness, one of the simplest pieces of advice to put in place is so hard. Because if you just say, I want to pay myself, it doesn't matter how much I get, I discipline myself. 10% of whatever I get or 5% is for me. I put it aside, right? You are spending less than you earn. The rest will follow, right? And you can see they are linked. Understand your relationship with money. Do a simple act of planning. We call it budgeting, yeah, right? And tracking what's happening with the monies. And finally, do you, not month by month, but let's say per quarter, are you making sure that you spend less than you earn? And of course, if it's not happening like this, what side hustle can I find to bring in more money? So for me, those three simple, and wherever you are, you can do them. I did them when I was selling fruit and veg. I'm doing them today. I teach at Gibbs.
Are you still selling fruit and veg?
No, I've graduated from that skill, but I learned a lot around life, just engaging customers. 7 months of selling fruit and veggies.
I'm sure. So when you were at your lowest point, yes, what belief or ritual kept you grounded?
Oh my
what
goodness,
do you that. Do today, even as an executive, yeah, or a lecturer, a professor that you are, to stay connected to the same inner strength that once kept you alive on the streets of Johannesburg?
Oh, what a beautiful question. So you want to know the rituals of Dr. Mann?
Yes, because the listeners are looking like, how can I replicate this? You know,
and you know, they call me Dr. Max and gives my students, I'm a man of rituals.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's
there
an appropriate
are many
question.
Rituals. There are a couple. So I'll share a few, maybe three. So the first ritual is gratitude. I wake up and I am grateful to be alive. When did that start, Sarah? It started in Hillbrow in 1993. I vividly remember about July 1993, very close to High Point, and there used to be Fontana Roastery there. I was walking there around maybe 2 a.m. Mm. It was late for me to walk across to Park Station, and I was mugged with nothing to give people. I mean, how do you mug a homeless person?
Wow.
Someone just showed me in an alley. They tackled me down. They checked. I had nothing. And then I realized, my goodness, it's dangerous to be on the streets of Joburg. I'd never thought about it that way because I slept at Park Station most of the time, right? And since that day, wherever I was, whether it was Joburg Park or it was Park Station or sometimes even toilets at Carlton Center, I would just say, wow, I'm alive. And I'm grateful for that, right? And of course, I build on during the day. I have my first coffee and I say, oh, wonderful. I'm able to even enjoy coffee. I'm grateful for that, right? So I'm grateful for small things. So every single day, for me, opening my eyes, I have a ritual of gratitude. And overall, I can say I have a ritual of gratitude for small things. That's one. What's my other ritual? Self-talk. Positive self-talk. My kids know it. Sometimes they even walk in a room and say, Baba, what are you talking to? Sometimes it's even loud. It's not even internal. Right? Where did I learn that? Yo, vets. I started first year, natural science, math, statistics. It was so hard for me. And I started by firstly saying, oh, I've been out of school for a while. You at vets 94, you matriculated 91. This gap is the problem. When I was failing, then I realized, no, that's not an excuse. And so began this ritual. Look myself in the mirror, right? In the morning. And I'd say, you may be struggling with statistics today. You may be struggling with actuarial science because it was hard. But you're making progress. That test, you got 58%. This one, you got 62%. There is something. So I stopped just looking at myself and said, I failed. And I started saying, no, you're getting better, right? And so something happens in class, I'm teaching at Gibbs. Maybe I didn't have order in the class. Maybe, you know, I didn't respond in a way I should have, because you know, a class of 80 can be quite challenging to manage. And I get feedback on that. And I look myself in the mirror just before I sleep, because that's also my other ritual I'll talk about. And I say, what did you do well, Dr. Max, today? What didn't you do well today? What are you going to improve? So I do both, so that I have what I can improve, and I pat myself on the back, right? Which takes me to my third ritual, self-compassion. So every evening, so you see, I start in the morning, gratitude, right? And reflecting. Positive self-talk as I'm going through the day. And in the evening, I close off with my self-compassion ritual. I ask myself three things. One, Dr. Max, have you been kind to yourself today?
Oh.
Given the pressures of teaching, the pressures of publishing, wanting to be promoted to a professor, managing a 24-year-old and a 21-year-old girls in South Africa today. All those pressures. Have you been kind to yourself? One. Two, I say to myself, have you been mindful? Were you aware of how you were interacting with others? Were you making people feel as if they matter? Right? Were you in tune with your thought emotion? That's my second practice. Right? The final one. Did you remember you're human? What do I mean by that? I'm reminding myself to stay grounded. Everyone matters. When I say, did you remind yourself you're human? When I say, of course I did. Then I say, please remember everyone is human. In crazy traffic, someone frustrated, that security guard, that homeless person. So those are my rituals. They've got to do with self-compassion, kindness, positive self-talk, and just saying it's going to be okay. Even if I'm going through obstacles, when I say, are you kind with yourself? No. Well, you must be kind to yourself even though your manuscript got rejected, because it happens to all of us.
Amazing.
So those are my rituals.
It was a bit emotional at some point.
Oh,
I think we...
goodness,
we
are. I'm so quiet. I'm like, what's going on?
No, I think sometimes we are too hard on ourselves, you know, and if we are not kind on ourselves, why should the world care?
Yes.
So it's important to say you did well.
And who knows that topic better than you on Everest, right?
Absolutely.
Be kind to yourself.
Absolutely. You have to be kind to yourself. But more importantly, keep stepping.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Frank, if you could speak to a young person sleeping on the pavement, on Park Station today or tonight, with no money, no network, no clear way out, what's their one message you would want to give them, or do you want them to hold on to until the sun rises the next day?
And how beautiful to just allow me one. And I know it. I would tell this young Frank who was there on corner Plain and Street Wanderers that you may be broke, you may be homeless, you may be unemployed, you may be hungry right now. Society might be judging you. You're uneducated, you're a petty criminal, you chose life on the streets. All that, put it aside. Why? You matter. You matter not because you have a home. You matter not because you have a job. You matter not because you have food to eat. You matter because you are human, period. And so, we need to start with our identity. That just says, I'm human. You matter to your family. You matter to your creator. Right? And if you feel you don't matter, I'm going to borrow your word. You don't tell yourself every day, I matter. Why should the world say you matter?
Yes.
So you matter because you are human, period. Once you have that mindset, the resourcefulness, the networks, the surviving is secondary, because your foundation of I matter because I am human works magic.
I love it. I feel like we are in a masterclass right now. Really in a masterclass. But all good things have come to an end, unfortunately. So here is our signature question. We all know shift happens always, as we were discussing. When shift happens in your life, what did it teach you about who you are and who you are becoming?
Oh, I love it. Who you are and you are becoming, a work in progress. For me, being homeless, rising through that in corporate and the opportunities that have been provided to me, made me realize that I matter. But beyond just the expression that I matter, made me realize that Frank, Sarah, Tobile, Nomonde, everyone out there, human beings, we have so much potential in ourselves. We've got so much power. We often see glimpses of that power when we overcome obstacles as the world shifts. Sometimes it shifts into adversity. Sometimes it's shifting into greater things. We get glimpses of that power that is in us. And so it taught me the power of the human spirit. And when you ask me, what am I becoming? Becoming an individual who inspires others in the various platforms that I get about this power inside themselves. If I can shift just one or two people, you matter. If for this power to overcome, then I have inspired belief in humanity.
Absolutely.
One by one, that I matter, irrespective of the obstacle I may be going through.
I love it. I mean, when I started climbing, my website said, I'm only an ordinary African woman trying to reach extraordinary heights.
Yes.
And the mountains taught me that that's not true. I'm uniquely extraordinary, and being ordinary is a choice.
There you go.
Uniquely extraordinary, yeah. Being ordinary is a choice. We are all born to make history.
Yeah.
We just need to believe it, to own it, and to walk like it.
Absolutely.
Having said that, your story reminds us really that resilience is not reserved for the few who seem unbreakable.
Yeah.
It's built one choice at a time by those who refuse to give up when life hits them the hardest. From sleeping on the streets to leading in boardrooms, you've shown that it's not our circumstances that define us, but the courage to rise above them. You know, your insights on purpose, persistence, and financial well-being are more than inspirational. They are a roadmap almost for anyone rebuilding their lives, one determined step after the other. So, Dr. Frank, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us and for such an inspirational and insightful conversation.
Oh, thank you for your kind words. It was great to be here.
So thank you, Frank, for sharing your absolute truth with us. And to you, the listeners, I hope you can feel the thinning air that is in here. Remember this, your greatest view isn't behind you. It lies beyond your hardest climb. The shift has happened. The question is no longer why it happened, but who you are becoming because of it. Don't wait for permission to begin your ascent. Don't let fear silence your potential. Seize the lessons. Own the steps. Command the future. If you would like to explore some of the lessons and tools we spoke about today, you'll find them in the show notes. If today's conversation spoke to you, share it with someone that's facing their own climb. Together, we are rising, one shift at a time. When Shift Happens is a Jackpod original podcast by Jacaranda FM. Let's go higher.